Do you feel like it's possible to find joy and positive change within veterinary medicine? Are you looking for a community that's striving for fulfillment rather than perfection? Hey there, I'm Dr. Stacy Cordovano. I want veterinarians to learn to be happier, healthier, wealthier, and more grateful for the lives that we've created. On this podcast, I will speak with outside-of-the-box thinkers to hear new ideas on ways to improve our day-to-day lives. Welcome to The Whole Veterinarian. Hey there. This episode is so amazing. You are going to get tons of actionable information today. I'm so excited to introduce Dr. Christine Staton. She is the founder of the Veterinary MBA, and the mission of her company is to help veterinary practice owners thrive by providing real-world business education and resources. Born from Christine's 20-plus years of service as a veterinary practitioner and practice owner, Christine understands the difficulties that veterinary practice owners face on a daily basis, and it's her goal to provide high-quality, concise business information for practice owners from a peer perspective. She is so generous in what she shares both on social media and in today's episode, so make sure to check out the show notes for ways to connect with her. You'll be able to find her online, find her courses, and connect with her to see if there's anything else she may be able to help you with. She is so passionate about this project, and I am so thankful of the time that she spent with me. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you found it helpful, please share it with a friend, because we all know that almost everybody out there in vet med is in need of tips and tricks to improve hiring in their practices. Please make sure to let us know what you think.
Platinum Performance is proud to support The Whole Veterinarian. For nearly 30 years, we've stood beside veterinarians with advanced nutrition for the health of your patients and practice. At Platinum Performance, we know the power of nutrition starts within.
Hey, Christine, how are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. Thank you for being here with me today. We have a lot to talk about, and I'm curious if you can tell listeners, before we really dig in, a little bit more about yourself and your journey and like why an MBA and where you're kind of at now.
Sure. It starts a lot further back when I was an undergrad, actually after I was an undergrad. Since I was 5 years old, I always knew I wanted to be an obstetrician. I had no desire to be a veterinarian. And
that's like the opposite of like, since I was 5 years old, everyone else on the show is like, since I was 5 years old, I wanted to be a vet. That's awesome.
Right. My puppy didn't die from parvo. Like, I have no good story of why I wanted to be a veterinarian at the beginning. So I was a pre-med student. I volunteered at human hospitals. I was pre-med. I had a pre-med club I started at my high school. I was pre-med all through my undergraduate. I took my MCATs. I applied to medical school. I went and interviewed at medical schools, and I did 7 interviews. Back then, everything's live. And every single interviewer asked me, why do you want to be a veterinarian? Which I thought was super weird. So, and I stumbled over the answer. And the reason they asked me this, I now know, is because I was a 4-H kid. I had multiple animals at my house. I raised and showed goats. I had horses that I showed. I showed my dogs. I had probably 7 species in 4-H. I was a 4-H leader at that time. It was something I was really passionate about. So anyway, I come back and I have my 8th interview I have to go to. And so I took pen to paper to say, I need to write an answer to this question. Like, why don't you want to be a veterinarian? Because I don't want to stumble.
Oh, why don't you want to be a veterinarian? Okay. Yeah. I misunderstood you. I thought you said they were asking, why do you? Okay. That makes more sense.
Oh, no, sorry. They said, why don't you want to be a veterinarian? And I couldn't answer it well. So I literally put pen to paper thinking, I need an answer to this so I don't stumble. And it hit me, honestly, like, why don't I want to be a veterinarian? So I, super analytical me, I set up a pro-con list of physician and veterinarian, and I wrote things out, and there were lots and lots of reasons to be a veterinarian that immediately made me switch. Like, I pulled all my applications from medical school because I didn't want to know if I got in. And then I had to call my parents and tell them I did this after all this time and investment that they had helped me through. But I was married at the time, and my husband and I decided that we're just going to do this crazy thing. And one of the main reasons was entrepreneurship. So I knew I wanted to own a practice. And in the world of being a physician, owning a practice is a lot harder. There were lots of other reasons, but for what we're talking about today, I knew I wanted to own a business. And that was important to me. And that was a main reason that I switched to veterinary medicine. I had to go back to college and take more classes. I worked with my local veterinarian who'd been my vet since I was 9 years old for a long time, and then was blessed to get in to veterinary school and never looked back. And I'm so grateful for what I did. So I knew I wanted to be a business owner immediately. The practice I was going into was a solo practitioner. She'd been ambulatory by herself, nobody for 20 years. And we had talked prior to me joining her that the path to ownership was already established in my first contract. So we had a 5-year path to ownership in my first contract because she was excited about me wanting to do things with the practice. And it turned out to be only 3 years. Within 3 years, we hit all the marks that we wanted to hit, and I was able to buy into that practice 3 years out of vet school. So I've loved that part always. And I always wanted to get an MBA, and I always wanted to be a really good business leader, and I wasn't at the beginning. But my partner had no interest in the business side of it, but she loved that the practice was gaining equity. As she was going to buy out later. Right. So it was a good relationship. And she retired 7 years ago, I think. So I've been a sole owner since then. But we built the practice up from just the two of us to now over 55 people. And I wanted to do better. I always want to do better. I want to lead better. I want to build better. I want to create a good place for people to work, honestly. So going back to get my MBA was for my practice. It was just a kind of selfish, like, I want to learn this better so that I can apply it to my practice.
That's amazing. I think that's very admirable. I think we could use a lot more really good leaders in veterinary medicine, to be honest, if we're thinking about culture change and, you know, making veterinary medicine a more positive place. Okay, so we talked before we recorded about what we wanted to talk about, because you and I are both interested in a lot of similar topics. But I think one that I haven't talked about much on here, and actually myself personally could use insight on, is hiring team members. So you just mentioned you went from 2 to 55. So I think you have some experience in hiring. So I'm curious, where do you even start?
Well, I started by making a lot of mistakes. I did it wrong. And I was the hirer. Like, I was the HR person at the beginning for quite a while. My husband quit his job and joined our practice in 06 because we really needed help. And he was a manager in the utilities area, nothing to do with veterinary medicine, but he knew how to manage. And he's currently our CFO and does all of that part. So I've not done a lot of the money part myself. But in terms of HR, that was on me for quite a while. I now have a manager that does that for me. But I think the first thing now, looking back, what we need to do and what we do now that's much better is we have to understand our purpose. What is our mission? What is our vision? What are our core values? And we have to really care about those deeply to know who we want to hire. They have to care about them too. And we hire for our core values almost exclusively. Like, that's the number one important thing. The people that we hire have to align with where we're going and how we're getting there. And if they don't, they're going to throw us all off track, even if they're great at what they do. There's some phenomenal technicians and veterinarians in this town that we didn't hire, or we did hire originally that did not fit our what we needed, and they're doing great jobs at the practices they are. It is no reflection of their ability or their performance. It just didn't align with ours. So that alignment, to me, is just number one. There's nothing you can do. You just can't get where you want to go if you don't pull the right people onto your team. So that's important. And then that includes lots of things. So we have, you know, things like policy manuals that people probably have, but they don't, like, they just have to have them for legal reasons. Well, ours matters. Ours is really important. We make them go over it. They read it before they accept the position in our building. They read it. We pay them to sit and read through it, ask questions. We have a code of conduct, which is similar to a policy manual, but it's line by line. They initial, we go over each thing with them. You know, this is how we behave here. Is this something you want? And you can say, no, I don't want to work there. Great. Let's figure that out before you get in our building, before we do all these things. Then we run tests. We do personality tests. We have an outside company that interprets those for us. It's not always a deal breaker, but it helps us know how they learn best and if the role that we're hiring for, if they might be not a good fit or a good fit for it based on personality tests. So I think setting all that up, having structure, having somebody who's going to care about the interview process and somebody who's going to care about the training and onboarding ahead of time is really important because you don't want to hire this great person, bring them in, and then they're just frustrated and flustered because we're not training them well. So getting that established has been really beneficial to us in our practice in getting the right people in the door.
Okay. So there was a lot of good information there. And we could talk about core values in like a whole other separate podcast interview. But practically speaking, what does that actually look like from a practical sense? So like, are all of your interviewees paid? So you mentioned you like pay them to sit there and read. So is this like a multi-day process? Is it a multi-step? Like how, kind of in a more practical sense?
Okay, so we break up our interviews, and this is like super the basics of it.
Yeah.
But we break up our interview. We get a lot of applicants, which is really great because we do a lot of things to get a lot of applicants. One is that our culture attracts them, but also we look everywhere. Like if I see a waitress that I like, I'm like, hey, want a job?
That's awesome.
And we've gotten people like that because we're looking for people that we really think would be a good fit, not necessarily skill sets. So we have a system, and the quick version is it's very quick. We get a bunch of applications. We skim through them very quickly. We know what we're looking for that particular position that we're looking for. So we can eliminate some of those pretty quickly. Then the other part of that is we have directions on how to apply. And if anyone applies that doesn't apply following those directions, we're not going to even look at them. Like we need to know that you can follow directions.
Yeah.
That's important for learning. And then we do a 5-minute phone interview, super quick. We know we ask just a few questions and we eliminate half the people in that. Then we bring them in for a group interview and we do a group interview, which is awkward to some people.
Yeah. Is that a group of applicants, like multiple applicants for the same position?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really fun because you learn a lot in a group interview because you see them interact with each other. Anyway, then we do individual interviews. Then we do what we call skills assessment, but it's really a working interview, but you can't call it that. We don't pay for any of those things. So none of that's paid for. Then when we're getting down to the last person and we make the offer, that's when we say, you're the person that we think we want. And let's go over all this stuff. Now that's a paid time. We're paying you to go through all this stuff with us. So they're essentially employed under the conditions they agree to all these things. And we agree to, you know, their schedule works and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's before they're actually physically working in the clinic.
Got it. Okay. That's helpful. I think I never would have imagined all those steps. But like you said, some of them are really quick and it's a good way to weed people out. I can imagine someone out there saying like, I don't have time to do all that.
It's so quick. It takes the same amount of time for us to process 10 applications than it used to for one.
Okay.
Group interviews make it really quick. We know what questions we're asking. It's not this long drawn out process. An interview of 10 people, a group interview plus the group interview plus individual interviewing all 10 of those people, it's like an hour or an hour and a half. And that's what we used to spend on one person. Mm-hmm. So I think we know what we want. I think that's the big part. We know what we're looking for now, and we can see that better because we're used to looking for it and asking the right questions.
And so that's based around core value, your practice's core values, but also what, the job description or?
Yes. Yeah. And I didn't mention that before, but you need a really good job description, obviously, too. So we know what we're looking for. We want them to see that and see what they're looking for, too. So in the actual ad, our ads are super brief. Hey, want to work here? If you're hardworking and you want to work at Adobe, apply. Like that's literally our ad. It's not, you have to have all these things. And now they can go to our website and get all the information on how to apply. And then it doesn't even have the whole job description, but it has enough stuff there to help. But the job descriptions where it literally describes everything that they're supposed to do and they're going to do and what they're responsible for.
Okay. I like it. That's really helpful for me personally. So I'm sure it's helpful for someone else out there too. I feel like I've fallen into a little bit of a mental trap of like, I'm not good at hiring people because I had a couple of was working one-on-one with them. So it has to be like just the right person. And I went through a couple of people and started getting like PTSD about hiring, but I did not do any of those things. So I'm definitely taking notes for the future. Okay. So another thing that I wanted to talk to you about, because I think this could be really helpful for a lot of people and it's a novel idea, is once you have this awesome team member and like your group of team members, paying them in a way that, you know, rewards continued growth and things. And you have talked about this idea of a tier-based compensation system. So I'm hoping you can elaborate for everybody and then kind of explain why it works so well.
Yeah. Well, all of my explanations have to start with the why, and the why is always the mistakes I made. So early on, when I was HR, I would hire people and I had no idea how to pay them. I had no idea what to hire them at. I would hire them at a wage that turned out to be higher than I should have sometimes, or lower than I should have, or I offered them a wage and they left because they didn't take the job when I really should have hired them at a higher wage. Like it was just too hard for me. And I'm same with raises. And I didn't know how to give raises, when to give raises. We tried the annual performance review. That was just kind of weird. And I didn't love that you were just getting raises because you'd physically been here. We also tried, what ultimately happened is somebody would come to me and they'd present, I think I should get a raise because, and I'd go, you're right, here's your raise. And then, so then the quiet people weren't getting the raises.
Like I was going to say, yeah, if it's for anyone who never did that. Yeah.
Right. So I'm a horrible leader in there like that. I just did it horribly. And I didn't know that I could get much better at it. I recognized in myself, like, this is something you're horrible at. And what happened, it was back when we had physical pay stubs that you got paper pay stubs. And a bunch of people went out to dinner from the practice and they all showed each other the pay stubs. And that was what it took for me because they are mad and they should have been mad. They were all making different amounts. Every one of them felt like they, like there was somebody who was making more than them that they should be making more than. It created a lot of problems in our clinic and I created those problems. And I recognized that. And when they came back in this mob and slammed their pay stubs on the desk, I looked up and thought, and I said, yeah, I'm really bad at this. Like, I don't know how to fix it. And the worst part is that I couldn't fix it right then because I couldn't just raise everybody up to the higher person because I couldn't afford to. Mm-hmm. So I lost some good people because of that, because they were upset and they didn't trust me anymore and they shouldn't have trusted me. One of my core values is integrity. One of our clinics is, and when I broke that, they were gone. So I said, well, how can we do this better? I pay my doctors based on performance, but that's based on what they're bringing in financially. And that doesn't translate exactly to everyone in the clinic. That can't translate to a receptionist, or it can't always translate to a technician either, truthfully. Mm-hmm. So I set on this journey to create this tier-based compensation that was basically performance-based and self-motivated. And it took me way longer than it should have. It took me 4.5 years to build this out for my practice. And it works wonderfully. And we've used it now for over 10 years. Mm. And it attracts the people that we want. And it retains the people that we want. So what it is everyone that's hired is hired at tier zero. No matter, there's exceptions and it's kind of more complicated than this, but it doesn't need to be complicated. They're hired at tier zero. When they're in training, they're tier zero. And then they have to hit tier one within 90 days. And then after that, it's all based on their own timing, like when they want to proceed up. So each tier has hard skills, soft skills, and knowledge in it. And they're things like place 5 IV catheters in a cat. So that might be in a tier. Another thing might be manage upset clients well. So that's a soft skill. something knowledge-based might be take this test on surgical instruments. So we have tests and we have logs where they log their skills. And then we have the soft skills that are things that they can work on. So it's all motivated by them. They bring it to me and say, hey, I'm ready for a tier evaluation. I think that I've completed everything for tier three. Can I request this tier meeting? And then I go through and see if they did all those things. And if they did all those things, then they automatically get tier three pay now. And they're a tier three technician or receptionist or pet resort attendant or whatever that is.
Wow. That's amazing. So for the soft skills, is someone else marking off that they've seen them handle a client well, or it's an honor system? Like, I felt like I had these three negative client interactions and I really handled myself well.
Oh, it's definitely monitored by everyone in the clinic. So what we do is, so let's say someone, and I say me because it used to be me, but now it's my manager, but somebody comes to me and says, they actually don't come to me, they have to email, I'm ready for my tier three evaluation. Great. So then when they email that, they put all their tests and logs in my box. I pull them out and I'll look through those. And yes, I'll spot check. Yeah, you did do these things. These are actual patients that came in. I've never had somebody falsify anything on them ever. Then I send out the tier requirements, the list of hard skills, soft skills, and knowledge to a lot of people in the clinic via email. And I say, Mary is requesting a tier three advancement. Can you please get back to me on, you know, your observations? So I send it to every doctor. I send it to key other people in the clinic. That might be receptionists, that might be techs, whoever. We just decide who works around them the most that should evaluate them. And it could be somebody who's a tier below them. It doesn't matter. And everyone's comfortable with this. Like, it's not a secret.
Well, because it's like the part of the culture of your practice, right? Like, yeah. They're used to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody's ever trying to undermine anyone. And that's one of the things with the tiers that is so great, is it really encourages cooperation and mentorship. You'll hear people say, hey guys, I'm so close to my tier, but I need to intubate a pig. And you'll say that during our morning huddle. And then later in the day, you'll hear the tech go, hey, go get so-and-so, relieve her out of that room. I got a pig to intubate. They're helping each other get through their tiers. There's no negative to them to help each other through.
Right. Because everyone can get there. Yeah.
Yeah. So they really are helping each other. So everyone wants people to advance through tiers, but they want to be honest. So then we meet them and we say, okay, I reviewed your tier stuff. These are the three areas that I think we're still going to help you with. And we want you to get through, but we don't think you're where you need to be for tier three right now. So let's talk about how we're going to get you there. And whatever that is, we're going to support you and get you there. It's not about, nope, you didn't make it, try again. Mm-hmm. Our goal is to help you, as the whatever position you are, move through those tiers and learn and grow. But there's so much put on to the actual team member to do it themselves. So I have I have techs in my practice that are tier one. Well, we have five tiers for technicians. So I have techs that are tier two who have been there for years and they're totally happy being there and they're not going to advance to tier three. And they're fine with it, and I'm fine with it. I don't need everyone to be a tier five tech. Mm-hmm. I love having a smattering of all of them, but there's not this, hey, nobody ever gives me a raise, I deserve a raise, because they know exactly how to earn more money in our practice. They know how they can do that. And even you'll hear, I had a technician say, we're starting to save for a house, so I'm going to work on my next tier. I was like, that's the coolest thing ever, because I'm not the bad guy that's not paying them enough. They know how they can make more.
Yes, I love that. I love that. And so all of it's self-driven except the first one. So to get out of zero, you have to do that within the first 90 days. And so then if that doesn't happen, are they no longer working there?
They're usually not going to be a good fit if they can't get through it, because tier one is essentially all of your orientation, your training. Mm-hmm. We call it establishment in our clinic, but so your orientation packet has every single thing in it that's in tier one. They're identical. So if you're not getting through, essentially that means you didn't get through orientation in 90 days. Mm. And we do orientation well now. We didn't used to, but we do it well enough now that if you're not getting through it, it's probably not going to be a great fit for our practice or our system. If you can't get through it, that part, you're not going to get through the other tiers and you're going to be frustrated with yourself. So we never are like, oh, it's 90 days, peace out, get out of here. We are attacking that person a lot during that orientation process. Like, whoa, we need to get you up to speed in this area. This is an area, you know, and we'll bring in, we'll, you know, say, okay, we're going to put you with this person for a few days. That wasn't originally the plan during your establishment, but we're going to put you with this person for a few days because we really need you to understand whatever, charging for dentals, equine dentals or something, and get them through it. So we're trying to get them through those 90 days. We're helping them. But yeah, if they're not getting to that tier one at 90 days, if we did our job, then they're probably not going to be a great fit for us. Now, there's times that we haven't done our job well. We have not done the orientation well. The person that was supposed to orient was sick. We threw them into rooms before they should have been. That's not fair to say, hey, we threw you into rooms so much that we never really got over into surgery in these 90 days. Of course, we're going to, that's on us.
Yeah, sure.
But if we do everything right, you should be established pretty well in 90 days.
Yeah, I asked specifically about that because I do feel like the hires I've made, I did kind of know in that 90 day period. And if there was something more structured in my onboarding or contract or whatever it was, I think it would have been an easier decision at that 3 month mark to say, like, you know what, this really isn't a good fit. You know, I didn't really have a reason because it wasn't something that they weren't doing because I wasn't tracking it well.
Yeah. And that's a help, right? That's a huge help for us because dragging orientation on for a long time, there's not a moment where you say, okay, this is the day. It's kind of, it's like laminitis, right? Laminitis is the worst disease ever because there's not this day that you're like, okay, this is the day that we stop treating.
Right. Yeah.
There's not this like moment. Yeah, that's why I hate laminitis so much because you just don't have that moment, that day. And I think that's kind of, I mean, obviously that's a morbid analogy, but we're talking to horse veterinarians, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. Having this, like, at 90 days, if you can't, it's easy to say, hey, you didn't get to this. And it prevents us from doing what we used to do, was literally have people in training for a year. And in equine medicine, that's a nightmare because they're essentially not bringing in their own income. If they're in the truck training with another technician, they're a complete loss in terms of their payroll. So, and we've spent 9 months training somebody once. And I was like, what? We've lost control of this. Like, I've paid a lot of money. I calculated it and it's like, oh, that's really expensive.
Yeah.
And it turned out we just changed how we trained that person and it worked out. And had we done that at day 60 instead of 9 months, we would have done well. And that person did great. Like, he ended up doing well.
Got it. Okay. So, I mean, we are talking about this from a business sense, right? Like, we're both practice owners and, you know, the ongoing costs of either replacing people or having, you know, technicians trained for an entire year and the cost of that. It's sort of a no-brainer to me. I hope people understand that this idea of, like, hiring well and then paying people well to keep them there and happy makes sense. I'm curious to hear your insight on the flip side of that, like, from a well-being perspective for your entire team. What have you seen this change or these changes that you've gradually made? What have you seen the effects of in your team's well-being?
So, selfishly, all of the anxiety and stress that I had with what to hire, what wage to hire for, when to give raises, how performance evaluations translate into pay raises, all that is gone. It does not exist in our practice. So I think that's huge from a management standpoint. For my well-being, it's fantastic.
Great.
Everyone knows their path. Everyone knows where they can go and grow in our practice. They also know the ceiling. Like, this is it. Like, I can't do more than this. And they know that from day one. So I think that's fair too, because that's a reality. If we're, you know, only a certain percentage of our gross income goes to non-doctor payroll, we have to stay within some guidelines. And I will, I'll say, obviously, I maybe not, it's not so obvious. We have posted in our lounge too, every position in our clinic and what the tier pay is for it. So tier one pay is this, tier two pay is this, tier three for a small animal tech, let's say. Those numbers change as the world changes, right? So, sure. So we will go through sometimes and increase all of them by 50 cents. So people who sit at tier two are getting raises without moving to the next tier because there's cost of living stuff.
Cost of living.
And
yes,
if sure. we're, if we are doing well, our practice knows that what percentage of our compensation goes to non-doctor payroll. And we talk about it at our meetings. So I'll say, you know, right now we've got a lot of people in training. We're at 25%. We really need to stay under 21%. So let's get these people trained. But I'll also come in and say, hey guys, everyone's trained. Everyone's doing their thing. Our compensation is down now at 19%. So we're going to be able to give a raise across the board to all the tiers. They know where that came from. It didn't just show up one day. They know that's because they increased gross within the practice. So it's, you know, it's based on that. It's based on law. We have people that come in just over minimum wage to work in our pet resort, high school students. And so as minimum, Arizona had some pretty dramatic minimum wage increases a couple of years ago that very dramatic, like multiple dollars from, mm-hmm. I think it went from 8 to 12 overnight or something. It was pretty wow. insane. Yeah. So obviously we had to take that into account and that did affect everything above it too. Mm-hmm. So that part's a little complicated, but going back to the culture of our practice, how it feels in our practice, I feel like everyone's helping everybody. There's not competition for, you know, who makes more, who doesn't make more, who gets the raises, who doesn't get the raises. I think it's a good thing. Like literally rolling it out was hard. That is, mm-hmm. that could be a whole hour on how to do that really well, because we made all of our employees start at tier zero, not pay wise, but skill-wise, and that there's things that I would have done a little better now that I'm better at change management. But we had a rough year and we did lose some people. And I think the people we lost weren't going to fit in the system. Mm-hmm. And some of them were great people. But if you're not self-motivated to move up, you either have to be content with living at tier two and or not work with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing that strikes me about it is the autonomy that it gives to people a bit, right? Because it's self-directed. It's not like someone in leadership is like, hey, you've been at tier two for 2 years now. Like, are you thinking, you know? So that's so important in burnout prevention, is to have as much autonomy as possible within your role. And I think that's such an interesting aspect of this that I hadn't even really considered until you dove deeper into how it works. I think that's amazing. So yeah, I have to imagine that the culture is much more positive, especially if the right people are there and they're not leaving, that just yeah. for morale.
And we do a satisfaction survey every year to our whole team. It's like 27 pages long and it's crazy. It's for our strategic planning. We do.
Yeah.
And we get input from them more frequently than that, obviously. That's just a big part of our culture. But on the strategic planning survey, there's a question that says, how would you like to be recognized? And it says public praise, private praise. It's kind of the love languages. Mm-hmm. But public praise, private praise, advancement responsibilities, gifts. I don't remember all of them. But mm-hmm. advancement and responsibilities is always the top thing they pick. They also like public and private praise, but advancement and responsibilities is what they pick. So to be able to reward them for those, to have those acknowledged, I think is a really good mentally for them too. We want to reward advancement, growth. We want to reward performance. We want to reward the self-motivation that's there. And they're not just looking at the end goal. They're excited when they get parts of it. Like they'll announce it in our morning huddle, like, you guys, I finally got that. Whatever, I finally got all my IV cat catheters on my log. Thank you all so much for helping me get there. That's real and happens in the mornings. Like people are talking about it. We've got a chalkboard and on it, it says tiers, and people can write, if they're down to like one or two hard skills that they need, they can write their name and that skill on that board and it'll be announced in our morning huddle. Hey, don't forget, Inez is still trying to get whatever. Mm-hmm. done. So I think it's just everyone feels better about helping each other and they feel better about accomplishing things on their own. We're not telling them what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. Are you guys huddling every morning before the day starts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we huddle every day. Our phones go live at 8 o'clock and we have a morning huddle at 7:45. It's very quick.
Very quick.
It's just, we work 4-day work weeks, everyone, but we're open 6 days a week. So we never have the same team on mm-hmm. ever. There's not a single day that it's like, this is the Thursday team, because mm-hmm. one of the other things that about our job that is good is flexibility. Some people hate it. They don't work for us. If you want a set schedule, this is a horrible place to work. If you like to get whatever day off that you want, whenever you want it off, this is a great place to work, because you have to work 4 of the 6 days and it's variable. It's really hard to schedule. My poor manager has to do that, yeah. but it's good for everybody. And that's why they want to be there. So anyway, it's a different team every morning. And we just talk about which doctors are on, which technicians are with each doctor, where our receptionists are. We have a front desk, but we also have an incoming call center that's not at the desk. So who's where in case we need to get a hold of somebody, if we have any openings, if we have any clients that we need to know anything about. It's 5 minutes. It's really quick. Yeah. And then we do say, we go over, this is kind of getting off topic, but we on that chalkboard, because I am kind of passionate about meetings not being anything that could be an email or an announcement. We have a chalkboard of announcements, and we anything that needs to be announced, anyone can write anything on it. And that it's announced for 1 week and then erased. So everyone will hear it multiple times. So like, hey, we got a new otoscope cover. You guys need to put it on the otoscope. Like that might be an announcement that's on there. And that way we don't have to talk about that at a meeting or something.
Yeah.
You know, waste everyone's time there. So that's on there. We talk about the tiers of the meeting. And then we ask how everybody's doing and if anyone needs anything for the day. And that's something we brought up recently. And it's really neat. Somebody, you know, last week said, you know, I'm just going to be honest. My kid was up all night. I'm exhausted and I'm going to push through, but just know that's kind of where I am today. It's a great thing to just kind of know where everyone is. Yeah.
Love that. Love that. Awesome. Well, there was so much great advice here. Thank you so much for sharing. I know you have so much other information to share with people with your courses and other things you're doing online. So tell people where to find out more about you.
Yeah. So what I do is I selfishly did everything for myself to make my practice better. And then I thought, I wish somebody had told me a lot of these things ahead of time. I can tell other people about them. And so at conferences, I end up talking to people and telling them, and I thought I can do this in a much more scalable way. So I do online courses for practice owners. They're masterclasses or workshops. I actually have a workshop on how to set up tiers in your practice. I think it's like a 6-hour workshop and it works you through. But everything's on our website, veterinary-mba.com.
Great. I'll make sure to link that in the show notes. You're also on Instagram at veterinary-mba, which I highly suggest everyone follow. Last question. What is one small thing that brought you joy this past week?
Oh, both my two of my grandbabies had their first birthday this week, and their birthday party was at my house.
Fun.
It was the greatest. Yeah, it was the greatest. It's so special.
That's awesome.
So that brought me joy. And I'm studying, my daughter's in veterinary school and she's studying for her board. So we sat together and studied tendons and ligaments on a horse leg. So it really, that brought me joy.
That's awesome. Great. That's so exciting. Well, thanks again for your time. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much. It was so fun.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Whole Veterinarian podcast. I so appreciate the time that you spend with me. To connect, please find me on Instagram at The Whole Veterinarian, or check out the website at thewholeveterinarian.com, and you can sign up for our monthly newsletter as well. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you soon.